Oh, hi, everybody. Work for long, Wednesday night. And for those of you online, I'm pleased to know you're there. So we'll begin as we normally do by taking refuge together, generating a mind of enlightenment, saying the prayers that come after it. Then we'll engage in the actual teaching itself. And as you know, there are spaces in there for questioning and also for meditating. So please get comfortable in your seat. If necessary, adjust your posture so that your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, your hands are in a comfortable posture along with your legs. Now you can leave your eyes as they are or slightly close them or close them completely, whatever suits you. Once you are comfortable, just relax and let the body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself, just relax into awareness. Then imagine that the ground beneath you is made of starry sapphire light, and all space is filled with rainbows and offerings. See that in the space directly in front of you. There's a lion throne, and on the seat of that throne are cushions of lotus, sun, and moon seat. And sitting on the moon seat is Buddha Shakyamuni. He's golden in color. He has the three robes of a monk. His left hand is holding a begging bowl, and the right hand is stretched down to touch the earth. He is surrounded by an assembly of other enlightened beings. These include Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, deities, protectors, and other beings. Meanwhile, you find yourself surrounded by all sentient beings. Your mother is sitting beside you on the left. Your father is beside you on the right. Friends and family are behind you. Difficult people are directly in front of you. Surrounding them all are strangers. Take a few moments to recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive. And to still have the leisure and the opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. So you have this leisure and opportunity, you need to act quickly. Those things are not quite right. The world doesn't exist as it seems to. And everything is in a state of flux and change. But nevertheless, you do have a spiritual friend who is leading you in the safe direction of the three rare sublimements, the Buddha, his teachings, and the Dharma. The thing is, the purpose of your life is to free all sentient beings from every form of suffering and to lead them to happiness. Especially the sublime, peerless happiness of full enlightenment. Since the enjoyments of your everyday life, every past, present, and future happiness, including enlightenment, is dependent upon other sentient beings. Decide that the happiness of these numberless sentient beings depends upon you. And if you generate love and kindness towards sentient beings, then all of them will receive no harm from you and instead will have peace and success. I think that therefore you yourself are responsible for the happiness and peace of all sentient beings. That you are in fact a servant here to serve every sentient being without discriminating between those who harm and those who help. So to be a good servant, to be without the sort of discrimination between friend, enemy, and stranger. For the success of all of this, you have to achieve full enlightenment. So decide that from today onwards, you're going to put all the actions of your body, speech, and mind into virtue so that you can be of the greatest benefit to all sentient beings, which means to achieve enlightenment as quickly as possible. So think that by being here tonight, by taking refuge, by engaging in the prayers, listening to the teachings, reflecting upon them and meditating, that all of these actions not cause the slightest harm to yourself or anyone else, but bring only benefit to all sentient beings in the best way, so that they too might achieve enlightenment as quickly as possible. So join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. You think that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And everyone's negative karma and obstructions are purified. Everyone's health and lifespan, virtues, and Dharma realizations are increased. They're cleansed by wisdom and compassionate love. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment to friends and hatred for enemies. Again, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve in yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And for yourself and everyone surrounding you, negative karmas and obstructions are purified. And your health and lifespan, your virtues and realizations are increased. So fortified with wisdom and compassionate love, just exhale and just relax. Then from that relaxed state of awareness, invite the field for accumulating merit. And before them, join me in saying, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. So having purified the body, speech, and mind somewhat and created some merit, to prevent ourselves from clinging to the merit we intrinsically existent or objectively real, recollect emptiness, that all phenomena exist apparently and upon mere name, being unable to be found when searched for using wisdom. Imagine that you're body, speech, and mind, your merits, your enjoyments, the world itself, the universe, utterly transformed, reappearing as a pure land. And this is the place where you give future teachings to your disciples. I think that you want to offer this pure land to the Buddha and the spiritual entourage. So you say, this ground, Anointed with perfumes, joined with flowers, adorned with mouth mirror, four continents, the son of the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of love. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. So release the offering, and the Buddha has accepted it with delight. He looks down at you and smiles at you. You look up into his gaze. Looking into the eyes of the Buddha, you recollect your wish to abandon the causes of suffering and suffering itself. You wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. And you have an idea of what the correct view is, but all phenomena are empty of an intrinsic nature, and being empty of an intrinsic nature exists dependently upon causes and conditions, their parts, consciousness, and name. Knowing all of this, you decide to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. So, induced by your wishes and prayers, there emerges from the Buddha a second figure who absorbs into you. And your form clearly becomes that of a guru Buddha. You just rest in your radiance. Then, from a hum syllable at your heart, life rays strike all sentient beings surrounding you. And they are all placed in the state of a Guru Buddha. And each of you have at your heart a moon disc, and upon it is the white mantra. And it's circled by the mantra of the Buddha, which you now begin to recite. Atayata Mahamunayasa Tayata Mahamunayasa Tayata Mahamunayasa. Now from the 10 directions of space, all the Buddhas dissolve into light, and this light is drawn back into your heart. I think the two purposes have been achieved. And you think that this is all on the level of imagination. Nevertheless, through this virtue, may you quickly achieve the state of a Guru Buddha, and place all sentient beings without exception in that very same state. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and move your limbs, shake your shoulders, stand, move around if you like, and just get comfortable with yourself. Okay, so this being our fourth class, we've covered some material. We know what meditation is. It's a process of either cultivating a virtuous mind, mental state, or becoming familiar with one. Why? Just to transform the mind from its present state to a better state. The state we're aiming for in the long term is called enlightenment, whereby we have perfect wisdom, compassion, and skill to help others achieve the same state. We looked at the posture, different ways of sitting. The most important is probably just having the spine straight and to be relaxed. And then last week we looked at the mind, and in particular, different forms of meditation that we can do with the mind, using stabilizing and analytical meditations. Now today, our topic probably seems a little simple, and pretty, there's not much to say, you might think. Nevertheless, I've used these books for putting together the information for tonight's class. So tonight we're going to be looking at intention and dedication. Now intention and dedication are obviously like the bookends of a practice, or the top and the bottom, or a means of containing the practice. So we begin our meditations with an intention. In other words, like, why am I doing this? What's the purpose? Then we do the actual practice itself, and then we finish, we dedicate the effort that we're putting to the meditation, directing it towards the goal that we originally set before the intention. The meditation itself, as you know, is become familiar with a positive state of mind and to decrease the negative ones. And basically, it's a process of mental purification and transformation. Now, this is a meditation itself, so I hope you can see that to do that, you need to direct the mind. This directing is the purpose of motivation. And basically, people have a number of different reasons for meditating. So I'll bring up these. They're basically, they're often said to be three, but in fact, there are four. So the first motivation for most people who come to a Dharma center, they begin by doing the practice to bring about benefit in this life. So either they're a little sad, distressed, anxious, there's something going on. They've probably read material, they might have gone to a psych, they might not have. But there's something going on, and just sort of wondering. And you think, oh, well, this is a good center, perhaps. They might have some answers. So you go there. And of course, nobody comes to these centers to inflict greater pain on themselves or hurt themselves anymore. I mean, you basically come here, to feel good in some way. In fact, when I used to do this many years ago, I used to ask people there, why are you here? And I always remember one young man who said, to make friends.
Oh,
I thought exactly the same.
that's so sweet.
I thought the same. I thought, how honest that they could just come out and say it just straight up like that. I'm here to meet people and make friends. So that was his purpose for being there. Over time, it changed, and this young fellow became a monk. And he's still a monk.
Oh.
So his motivation changed. But that was his original intention. And so this is probably the intention for most people who come to a Dharma center. There's just something going on. You want to feel better about yourself and how you're living your life, or you try to look for explanations of why things are the way they are, or what's the meaning of your life, all those deep philosophical questions. You might come along to have an answer. Now, practicing with that intention is seen to be a non-dharmic activity. So there are, in other words, so they're meditating primarily to be of benefit in this life. Like I said, now nearly everybody starts there, but from a Buddhist point of view, it's not seen to be the practice of Dharma. So Dharma has a number of different meanings. One of them is just means to hold. One of the simplest meanings of Dharma is to hold. So you go like, to hold what? And there's a couple of different meanings here. One of them is to hold the identity of the object. That's the Dharma. Dharma holds the identity of the object. So this is the Dharma. This is the Dharma. You and I are Dharmas. It's just an idea of identifying phenomena. Saying, well, this is a thing and it holds an identity. It has an identity. That's a simple way. And we talk about it like this through the little d, dharma. But there's another Dharma, these are the teachings of the Buddha, that's often spelt with a capital D, not to differentiate them. The meaning is the same, to hold, but what it's holding is quite different. And what it's holding is the mind of the sentient being away from suffering. So when we study Dharma or engage in Dharma, that's its purpose. It's to keep the mind back from suffering. So can you see here why these practice to benefit this life of being non-dharma? Can anybody see why that might be? Yeah, I think it's quite obvious, right? No, we should all try to be happy in this life.
Yeah.
Definitely. No, we can't knock that one down. We have to do that. You have to be happy in this life. But being happy in this life doesn't mean to say it's dharma. That's what we sort of say. You can practice Dharma and it will benefit this, it will bring about benefit in this life, right? But it's still, it's not seen as Dharma. Why? Because this life will come to an end and you will not have put an end to suffering. Suffering has gone through all this life, right up to the moment of your death. You'll die with suffering, you'll be confused in the bardo state, and you'll take rebirths with suffering. So Dharma doesn't hold you back from suffering. It's done for this life. It can hold you back from the suffering of a future life if you practice Dharma now. Because you take away the causes to be reborn in lower realm existences in the next life.
And you can also, if you do it with that motivation, paradoxically, it really helps for this life too.
That's right.
Like,
that's
like right. Wanting, wishing happiness in everyone makes you happy.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so this is why even when they talk about the mind of enlightenment, where it seems to be aimed at the other, the major person who benefits is you.
Exactly.
So it's not that, like, it's not like you miss out because you really care about everybody else. No, it's just that everybody else is primary. You're secondary, but you still get, you still be happy. Whereas if you turn it around and go, I've got to make sure I'm happy. That's uncertain, but you'll be certain there are a lot of people that aren't when you put yourself up front and center. Yeah, so I've joked sometimes here saying, look, why don't you try to go to work tomorrow and don't give care about anybody there? Just care about yourself. See what happens. Yeah. And maybe next week go back and you really care about everybody else and put yourself second and see what happens. You probably notice quite a difference. It's a similar idea, like if you aim for future lives, you will be happy in this life. But if you aim just for this life, there's no certainty at all that you'll be happy in the next life.
Or in this life.
Yeah, or even in this life. This is as we see all the time, isn't it? There's no certainty that happens at all. Yeah, so it's really hard to hold yourself back from suffering in a life that's, you know, underway already. And, you know, all of us are getting older. We're going to have the suffering of old age. Change is taking place all the time. The things that used to please us don't please us now. There's a suffering of change. And we have no control over this body and mind and the outer world. But, you know, very little, if any. So that's all called suffering. It's the suffering of conditionality. So we won't be holding ourselves back from any sort of suffering. Right? And that's the meaning of Dharma. Yet this is the beginning. Right, and so this is why you get this chance to often say now, what's it, let's not reflect on your motivation. What is purify your motivation? No, Gishi's up to say something else, isn't he? He's got this lovely little phrase. Refresh your motivation. He says now it's time to refresh the motivation. Because we all know we want to be happy. And I mean, that's one of the reasons we're here. Right? It's very interesting, though. But we want to be happy, like, now. It's not like we want to wait for later, you know, get to heaven or something. No, we want to be happy now. So this is not seen as a Dharma motivation. But the next one is for the benefit of future lives. So if you're aiming for a life beyond this life, you go, okay, now you're practicing Dharma. For the benefit of future life. So what this means is that you do not want to take a rebirth that is less than a human being. Why? Because you have no real good access to Dharma. You're sort of stuck in that body. Your understandings of Dharma are highly
limited
is a good term. Yeah, limited. So you don't want that because it's once you die in that body, there's going to be another body. You're going to have another life, right? And it's very difficult to determine where you're going to be born if you die as an animal. Whereas as a human, you always have this chance, and you have a chance to set a motivation every time. You go, this is the purpose of every action I do. This is the driving force behind every action. So very ordinary actions, once you know about a bodhicitta, for instance, can become very powerful actions. Whereas they're not, they're ordinary if you're an animal, aren't they? You're just going to sleep. If you're born up in those higher realms, the pleasure is so great that you don't even know what suffering is. You don't feel it at all until the very last moment of your death. So you don't really care about others. You've accomplished what seems to be your welfare. You feel terrific. You've got everything. But you're not going to get involved in the spiritual course of action if you feel like that, are you? You know, like, what's suffering? I need to get rid of. Come fine. So here's the beginning of a motivation, a Dharma motivation, if we practice for the sake of future lives. But from a Mahayana perspective, this is not good enough either. This is not really, it is a Dharma, but it's not the best Dharma. What's a better way of practicing, a better goal, is Nirvana, personal liberation. And so that way you will at least accomplish your welfare. You will put an end to the causes of suffering, the origins of suffering. And you will not take rebirth again into this realm that they call psychic existence. You won't go through suffering again. Again, but from the Mahayana perspective, this too is not good enough as a motivation. So you see here, and this is how I started off today, is that they all lead you to enlightenment is the goal of the Mahayana practitioner. So through this enlightenment, you will achieve what they call nirvana. There will be an absence of causes of suffering. You will not have the causes of suffering anymore. But altruistic enlightenment or Buddhahood is called a non-abiding nirvana. So it means that you don't abide in the solitary peace of nirvana. So the solitary peace just means your mind stream does not have any cause of suffering whatsoever. You can't experience any suffering whatsoever because you don't have the causes. You're at ease, they call it, in a peaceful state, nirvana. So you just stay there like that. You have no interest in others or anything like this. So you have accomplished the welfare. What if you say these higher goals being enlightenment for the benefit of all beings? Well, fine.
Right.
Because that's still in there.
Yeah.
It's just a way of making it more.
If you're sort of miserable in this life, it's kind of hard to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
In fact, I've heard oftentimes that the person who engages in Buddhist meditations needs to be mentally well. Because you start like the same thing, you start thinking about it all these lives, you've got a lot of thinking to do here. So the big motivation is Buddhahood, omniscience. So when you understand your own motivation, this really helps you set really clear goals. And as you can see, these meditations range from self-benefit to benefiting all sentient beings. And there are teachings that are set out that suit each of these motivations. If you wish to achieve the altruistic enlightenment of Buddhahood, then you need to engage in all the teachings. If you were to just do personal liberation, well, no, you wouldn't do the teachings involved with Buddhahood, the six perfections and so forth, or four means of gathering disciples. You wouldn't do that because you're only working for your benefit. If you're going for the benefit of future lives, you probably wouldn't engage in practicing personal liberation or Buddhahood. Your goal is not that great. In fact, I remember this story about so I read different biographies, and what I've noticed in reading autobiographies about boxers is that nearly all of them, especially women that come from poor backgrounds, their motivation for boxing is to buy their mother. I'm pretty sure too.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, most boxers never make it to be able to do that. But those who wish to be boxing world champions, they often might not make world champion, but they make enough money to get their mother a house.
But shoot for the stars.
That's right. That's exactly right, Sandy. Shoot for the stars. You might land on the moon. So I think the same thing myself. This is my attitude. Is to say, okay, why not aim high? And perhaps you'll get somewhere along the way. One of the things you could be sure of, it is certainly for the benefit of future lives. You have the mind of enlightenment. You think, like me, I'm in my 70s now. I'm sitting here thinking, it's not going to happen this lifetime. But having the attitude might carry me through to have a good future life, and I can keep going. Because for me, it's like, it takes a long time to work out what works for you, to find a path that suits. And for me, this path suits. But at the same time, I'm rational enough to go, I don't have renunciation, karma, all these different milestones you could find on the map to enlightenment, and go, that's not me. Left my run too late. But I can develop a good heart I can die well. Well, hopefully. That's the other major thing that you find even the lower scope is how to die well. You are going to die. This is what you need to do. Get that future, that good future life. And the lovely thing about what to do there is you just need to die with a virtuous mind. There's all sorts of different tracks in here, but that's the essential point. Virtue. I can die with virtue, I'm assured of a higher realm rebirth. I've got to get that. So Khyentse Rinpoche said, like, you know, if you find that you've died and then you find yourself in some strange animal body, understand that you just wasted the previous life. Yeah, so I didn't forgot that. I went, holy heck, that's right. These are some of these motivations for meditating. And so this altruistic wish to attain enlightenment is really important. The mind of enlightenment, or bodhicitta, is the most powerful motivation because it transforms every action into a cause for the ultimate happiness of all beings. That's what's terrific about, like, washing the floor, going to anything created with this mind of bodhicitta. If you can also combine it with your understanding that all phenomena are empty, that's even more powerful. And once it's created, it can't, if you dedicate it to enlightenment at the end, the virtue can never be lost, unlike all other virtues. Every other virtue can be lost, except virtues sealed with the mind of enlightenment. But so they often compare, you know, like when you go up to a tree, and trees have these trunks, and you get like your axe or something, you cut into it, you nearly always get solid wood, don't you? That goes chop, 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 chop. One, the tree goes down. But if you go up to a banana tree and go chop like that, you're right into the trunk. The trunk is hollow. It's just made of these leaves. There's no actual wood in it. And he says, that's what it's like dedicating ordinary merits. But they don't have that. Whereas dedicating a merit seal with bodhicitta, that's different. Those aren't lost. Then especially they're not lost to anger and wrong views. Where every other virtue can be lost to anger and a wrong view. So with this altruistic intention to become enlightened for the benefit of others, it's really great if you can sort of just slow down and just, even if you're not really confident about your understandings of emptiness, still say something like, I am empty from my own side. And so is the mind of enlightenment. And so is the goal I'm seeking. Nevertheless, I'm looking for sentient beings. So it just takes away this idea. You know, sometimes what happens when you do this, you feel good. You should feel good too. But then the I that feels good is held in a non-existent way. So we call that, so it's like poisoning the virtue. So one part's right, mind of enlightenment is right, but how this phenomena exists is wrong. So that's weakened. So you want to get your idea of yourself, the sentient being, and the virtue. Subject, object, and action are all empty of any intrinsic nature, meaning they're all dependent. So you need to remind yourself like that. Otherwise, it will happen very quickly, as you seem to be separate from the whole thing and feel great. The Buddhahood is separate from all of this. It's not. It depends upon the mind of enlightenment. Right? So you've got to bring in this dependent origination. They call this the emptiest of the three spheres, subject, object, and action, meaning that none of these three spheres has any objective existence. None of these spheres objectively exist. And that is true. That is the way things are. So, yeah, so altruism, or this mind of enlightenment, it transforms ordinary activities into this, you know, wonderful result. Now, bodhicitta is the root of the Mahayana path. So there's no Mahayana path without the mind of enlightenment. It shifts the focus from me to we. We are all the same. This is where it comes from. This is why we do it. There's no difference between us. You are just like me. Now, if I look for you using an analytical wisdom, I won't find you. Now, if I turn around and do it on me, I won't find myself either. This is the nature of all phenomena once you subject them to analysis. You don't find them to objectively exist. That's just the way things are. It's not saying they don't exist, is it? We're just saying not objectively, not inherently, not intrinsically, not naturally. That's what we're saying. We're saying not like that, but like this, dependently. Buddhahood is a dependent arising. Buddhahood depends upon me. It will depend upon you knowing what that is. It depends upon a teacher. It depends upon sentient beings. It depends upon us actually ridding the mind of its obscurations. But it depends upon so much, doesn't it? So it can't exist as an independent entity. Because it's dependent. If you look at yourself, you go, we're the same. We depend upon the space we're in, the air we breathe, the water we drink, a mother, father, brothers, sisters, food, so many dependencies. So we cannot be independent entity. The object itself, bodhicitta, well, tell me, what does that depend upon? The mind. And the development, first of all, equanimity, to understand all beings of being your mother. They have all been kind to us. We want to repay that kindness. There's all sorts of dependencies there. So straight away, okay, that removes the idea that it could objectively exist. It needs other phenomena for its existence. This is the nature of everything. So we need to tell ourselves this. Because otherwise we're going to think, I've got the mind of enlightenment, or I don't have it. And then we got one is rarefied and one is like nothing. Yeah, no. Now, when we look at this bodhicitta or mind of enlightenment, simply put, it's the wish to become a Buddha to help everyone. It's a wish to become a person who has fully developed their wisdom, their compassion, and their skill. So now they can help others effortlessly and spontaneously. That's our goal. That's what it means to become a Buddha. And we say, well, that sounds like a great goal. You know, another human being achievement, I want to give it a shot too. Now, especially when you consider, when you think of this thing about like countless past and future lives, that there's this phenomenon called death. You know, we will vanish from this world and then we're going to reappear again. But not in a way that's instantly recognizable. You know, it's got to go on and on and on and on and on and on. And all the time, you'll want to be happy. And all the time, it'll be confusing until you are. But somewhere along the line, I'll say, in this life, here we are. But now we're listening. Now we're sort of thinking, oh, this might make sense to me. This seems like a good idea. Well, it'll be a good idea at your death too, right? It's like I said, you've got to work it out now. So this is a great idea. Well, it'll be a great idea when you die too. It'll be a great idea when you're reborn. So you want to reconnect with it, make it strong while we're here. Now, this saying, this thing about motivation, comes up in 7-point mind training. And then there's just a line that says, two important points. One at the beginning and one at the end.
I love the job, but
yeah, me too.
It's
so streamlined, it's so direct,
yeah,
straight to the point.
That's it.
Like that, there you go. You can't, it's difficult to misunderstand what they're talking about. Yeah, so here we're talking about this intention. Of course, here, the important point, one at the beginning is motivate with the mind of enlightenment, make it a Mahayana practice. Make it about us. So if we can motivate with this attitude of becoming fully awakened for the benefit of others, Again, so some advice from Kinsa Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Sering. One time we were saying this, body teacher. We all say this. What's it mean? And it really just, everybody went, well, it seems so simple. And then suddenly, it was like everybody's mouth went dry. But it just, look, it means that you wish to have perfect wisdom, perfect compassion, and the perfect skills to work with everybody, to help them. That's it. So I like that. Like, put it in your own natural language and go, sounds like a great idea. Wouldn't I like to have perfect wisdom, compassion, and blue? I bet you I would. That would make helping others so simple, wouldn't it? You say, so when you say this stuff, this is what you mean. Now, what the mind of enlightenment does, what's major challenge, what it works against, is what's called self-cherishing. Self-cherishing is a consciousness that, from a Mahayana perspective, is a wrong consciousness. What it does, it focuses on the wrong conception that you have about yourself and makes you indifferent to others' welfare. Because I am more important than you. My desires and matters are of greater importance than yours. That's the self-cherishing. It, I often find it manifesting in my own life when you say, I don't care what you think. You know, you go, I don't care. That's the example of your self-cherishing showing up. Why, who do you care about? Well, me. I don't care about you. So the mind of enlightenment works against that, goes, well, now guess what we're going to do? We're going to care about you. You're going to make self second and others first. And that's how we're going to work. But remember here, the self-cherishing is not coming out of, it's not rational. But like I said, it's grabbing a wrong idea and then running with it. The wrong idea comes out through self-grasping. Self-grasping grasps or holds the I in the wrong way, in a false way. And self-cherishing goes along and doesn't know that, and goes along with self-grasping. Oftentimes they call the one's the prime minister and one's like the treasurer. So in a government, they're the major things, aren't they? You've got the treasurer and then the prime minister. They're the number one and two. Self-grasping is like the prime minister. Self-cherishing is like the treasurer. And they're both wrong consciousnesses. Self-grasping is attacked using the wisdom realizing emptiness. Self-cherishing is attacked using cherishing others.
Can I just add something to it here? It seems Geshe Zopa said something that was really, for me, profound, but it makes a lot of sense. He was saying that guru devotion, being, you know, properly devoted to your guru, is a direct antidote to the self-cherishing.
Yeah, for sure.
So I didn't think about that, but when he said it, I'm just like, it's obvious,
yeah,
right?
That's right. You cherish somebody much more than yourself.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah, but also, like, you know, like, doing the things the guru says, like, for instance, like, that's, you know, how he described it. It's like, guru, you're a robot, and guru has got the remote. That's what he says.
So, yeah, one of the fantastic things about devoting yourself to the guru is how this works against your ego as well.
Yeah.
Like I said, yeah. Wisdom realizing emptiness is the main thing to get ego grasping. But with ego grasping, there's a lot what they call self-cherishing, indifference towards others, needs number one. You combat that by, first of all, having a teacher and making them more important than yourself. But then it's also said, then you see your teacher as a Buddha, but once you do that, you see all sentient beings as Buddhas. And again, they're more important than you.
Use like a mind exercise of going back to like the moment you were born. Obviously somebody picked you up. What if no one picked you up?
Yeah.
What if no one gave you milk? What if no one dressed you? Yeah. Like,
Well, we know what happens to those children, don't we?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like we're so 100% dependent on the kindness of others that, you know, it's such a wrong view to think that we're more important.
Yeah.
You know, because
yeah,
you just have to sort of look at the scenario of life.
Yeah, yeah,
there's no one to teach you, you wouldn't be able to read. Like, it's just a long list, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right, Sandra. Yeah, and then somewhere along the way, we're sort of encouraged to think of ourselves as being independent, not depend upon them, and it's up to us, sort of idea. And well, we know where we are with that. So with this bodhicitta motivation, so it's just, you know, if you have a look at the book, The Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the first chapter starts off talking about the benefits of bodhicitta, of this mind. And then Kunu Lama Rinpoche wrote a book called Vast as the Heavens, Deep as the Sea. And it's just the whole book is the benefits of bodhicitta, of this mind of enlightenment. So there's a couple of things about this mind. One is the scope of it. It's like all sentient beings and enlightenment as well. So it's like, you know, like every sentient being and then the highest goal, Buddhahood, omniscient Buddhahood. So that's, you know, in terms of the power, it's like I would have an omniscient mind, I would know how to behave, to speak, and do all these sort of things, whatever was required for another sentient being to help you. And yes, for all sentient beings. And of course, it does lead to this full result of Buddhahood. Without this mind, there is no Buddhahood. So you wish to become a fully awakened being, a Buddha, you need to have the mind of enlightenment. Now, not only do you need that mind, so there's really two really, really important minds. And I read a book just recently where the author began by thanking the Buddha for what he brought into this world. And so the Buddha brought two marvelous things into this world, the mind of enlightenment, and the wisdom realizing emptiness. He's right. That's right. You know, if you sort of think about it, you go, I can't think of a mind better than the mind of enlightenment. And there's no wisdom greater than the wisdom realizing emptiness. And so just there you go. Yeah, it's true. It's fantastic. Like if you can get this generated authentically, I'm always impressed with Lama Zogu Rinpoche, especially that, you know, when you dedicate at the end, and he talks this armor-like patience, like he never gave up on sentient beings. And I often feel like giving up on them. It's like, geez, they drive me nuts. it's not going to work. You can't be indifferent to them. That doesn't work. And neither does disliking them. Neither of those two options can work. So you're going to have to work out a way of liking sentient beings. And like Sandy said, well, guess what? Without them, you wouldn't be here. Sentient beings have birth to us, someone picked us up, fed us, the whole lot. So all that came about through the kindness of sentient beings. And this is what it's asking us to recognize. Look, whatever you have came about through the kindness of others. Surely, like, you want to repay that. Well, the best way you can do it, of course, is to become the fully awakened being. So I'll just open up now for some questions, if you have any. So far we've spoken about this altruistic motive, enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, for our bodhicitta. That's the supreme motivation. And it's the one we need to bring into whatever we do as Mahayana practitioners. So I think all of us may have some, not sure, most of us have some sort of, have had initiations into different practices. If you had an initiation into a practice from mantra or tantra, that practice was taken on the basis of you having a mind of enlightenment. Even if it's not an authentic mind of enlightenment, still you wish to do it. You know, you've looked at it and gone, yeah, I agree. Makes sense to me. I know I'm not, I don't have it, but it makes sense. So on that basis, you can take the initiation. But if you don't know what it is, you can't take that initiation. And if you did take it without a mind of enlightenment, you're not going to get enlightened. Yeah, so it's a really important mind. And one of the great things that helps us remove is some of the different problems that we have. And one of the greatest, of course, is this mind of indifference, of not caring about others. And so we can see what's happening all over the world because we're encouraged not to think well of them, to demonize them, to put them out on the edges and the fringes, and even call them non-human beings, relate to them as non-humans, so we can hurt them, so it doesn't matter. So the mind of enlightenment goes completely against all that. It's quite a reversal of view. But like Sandy says, if you just think about it, we'd be nowhere without the kindness of others. We wouldn't exist. In fact, as I was saying to Sandy, or hinting at it, but we all know what happens when you not care, don't we? And so we showed that those, you know, in Romania was in Kosciuszko that were killed. And then they went into the orphanages there and saw all those children that had not been cared for, had no affection. And they're a mess. So kindness and love are essential for human beings. And kindness and love are the foundations of the mind of enlightenment. It comes out of it. Without kindness, love, without love and compassion, you cannot have a mind of enlightenment. Without having a mind of equanimity, you're not going to get one either. So it's of great importance, this mind. Of course, not easy to develop. You've got a lot of resentments. You've got a lot of hindrances. But the great thing about all those resentments and hindrances, they're all based on false premises. So we just find out the lies we're telling ourselves, we could put them aside and bring into it, just like you're saying, Sammy. Actually, people have been very, very kind to us. I need to become more familiar with that than what they haven't done for me or how they threatened me. Yeah, so this mind of enlightenment helps us get rid of some of the different confusions we experience, especially, like you're saying, to look at others and demonize them and see them as like non-human. Bodhicitta goes completely against that. So let's do a first meditation, and then we'll come forward in the seat. Just check your spine now. Is it straight? Are your shoulders relaxed? Yeah, so find yourself in a dignified posture. Like I said, your back is straight. Your head is sitting nicely on your neck. Eyes partially open, so a little bit of light comes in, and you're breathing normally and naturally. So the true purpose of the practice of meditation is to remove the inner veils of confusion and the emotional habit that obscures the mind's natural clarity. If we can remove those veils, we uncover our innate capacity for wisdom and compassion. We can bring about personal states of personal peace, and we can also effectively help others. So to meditate successfully, to achieve one of the great goals that we've set, enlightenment for the benefit of others, this mind is a union of this altruistic motive and wisdom realizing emptiness. So the wisdom realizing emptiness removes the mental veils. And this union of an altruistic motive and wisdom is like lighting a lamp, but not just for yourself, but to brighten a room whereby the whole community can see. So why might this altruistic motive be considered so very powerful? It's considered to be very powerful because it expands our purpose beyond personal comfort. So how much you recognize when your own practice is becoming self-focused rather than altruistic? See if you can use the metaphor of the lamp to do that. So how might you recognize when your own practice is becoming self-focused rather than altruistic? Or using the analogy of the lantern, or the light, you might notice that you're only concerned with this lantern hanging in your own room. You forget that there's others out there in the darkness and that they too wish to see. So try to make your intentions a source of light for all beings, rather than just for yourself. And know that every moment that you spend developing, realizing, recognizing the clarity of your own mind, you are contributing to the brightness of this world. And then breathing in. Exhale, let your eyes flutter open, move your shoulders, and bring your attention back to the room. Now, I've drawn up the slide to sort of show you how there's always two things you're doing when you're meditating. And these are basically you're trying to get rid of something and you're trying to promote something. And these can be summed up in the word Sangha, meaning Buddha. So Buddha, you're trying to remove the obscurations, you're removing all the hindrances and problems. And on the other side, in the absence of all that, all the good qualities are developed. That's always comes down to that. You look at yourself, what am I trying to get rid of? What am I trying to develop? Or what am I trying to remove? And what do I want to develop? So what we're trying to remove is called the two obscurations. So the obscurations are the afflictive obscurations and the cognitive obscurations. The afflictive obscurations are ones I'm pretty sure you're all familiar with, things like hatred, anger, any sort of mental states that really disturbs the mind. That's an afflictive obscuration. The cognitive obscuration is where the mind is obscured so that everything appears to exist objectively, have its own nature. That's the cognitive obscuration. If you want to know that you've got it, just look at something and go, does it seem to be over there? And if you say, yeah, that's it. You know, if we look at ourselves as subject and object, and if the object seems to can exist without a subject, that's it. That's the wrong idea. It always looks that way, but it's not true when you analyze. So you want to remove these two obscurations and end up with the two bodies of a Buddha. We also wish to generate compassion and wisdom. So of course, we remove the these two obscurations, and that's what we can replace them with. We wish to support the mind of enlightenment. Building of this mind of enlightenment. But of course, once you have bodhicitta, it needs to be developed, and in many stages of the practice, it has to be maintained. I'm not sure I'll talk to you about that. And what are we trying to achieve on Buddhahood? This leads us to this next slide, two important points, one at the beginning and one at the end. So now we'll look at the end. So, of course, what we're talking about here really now is the dedication. And when we dedicate, there's a number of different factors that are quite important. So I've mapped out six of them. So what are we dedicating? And the answer is your virtues. So while we've been sitting here, energy has been expended all the times that we need energy to sit, energy to think. Well, we began by setting a good motivation. That motivation is virtue. Since then, anything that we've done has been influenced by that motivation. If you haven't got angry while we're sitting here, or you haven't developed a completely wrong view, that merit, that energy that you gather up and create it can lead to something, can produce something. So that is what's called this virtue. All this energy, this good energy while we've been here, hasn't been so yet. That's what we're going to go. Okay, that, we'll go over there. And why do you want to do this? So it's not lost, it's not dissipated. You know how often it is it? Like, you come along with something like this, or Geshe's opens here, or any of the great teachers are here. Many times, wow, you really feel good here, feel empowered, feel like, yeah, this is the right thing for me. But two or three days later, you might feel completely different. If you go home and then your mum or your dad or somebody you really like gives you a mouthful, it suddenly becomes very difficult. It's like all that goodness just gets sort of shaken up and off to the side, and we just become our normal selves, don't we? We forget about everything we've heard, and we either don't like them or we say something fierce, So that's what I mean by being lost. What we develop is just dissipates, falls away. So we don't want that to happen. That's, we want it to become, so it becomes inexhaustible because sentient beings are inexhaustible. Like, as long as a sentient being that exists, I have this intention to bring them to enlightenment. So my merit remains. While sentient beings remain, the merit remains. And what's our aim? Of course, one, it's supreme enlightenment. That's where we're going to dedicate it for. We'll do that at the end of our class too. And who's it for? Like, for everyone. We want everyone to become fully awake. We don't want anyone to suffer at all. I want whatever goodness I do to go to that goal. I don't want anyone unhappy and suffering. Yeah, so that's a how do we do it? So the method, that's the mind of enlightenment. My wish, that the energy that I've created by being in this classroom produces enlightenment for all sentient beings, with the knowledge that I don't exist from my own side, meaning you can't find me between the top of my head and my feet. I am not the body, I'm not the mind, I'm not something different from them. That's the wisdom. Sentient beings, they're the same. They're not their bodies, they're not their minds, they're not something different either. The mind of enlightenment is dependent upon the mind. It's dependent upon sentient beings. It's dependent upon that Buddhahood exists. Buddhahood exists, then there are causes for it. So the mind of enlightenment depends upon all those causes. So it has no natural existence. It can't objectively exist. It exists dependently, like everything. So we just remind ourselves that that's how we unite them together. And we say, we want this never ever to be lost, to be a complete cause for enlightenment. Now this, I'll lead you now to a dedication that we do, and we'll do it again tonight. But I want to talk a little bit about this dedication and how it can sort of tie into this. So at the end of our class, we'll be saying this dedication. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as human beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. So His Holiness is his favourite dedication prayer of His Holinesses. It comes from Shanti Deva's text, Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And it sums up the whole text, everything that text, I don't know how many, over 1,000 pages or whatever, all of it is in this verse. In fact, chapter 10 is summed up by, as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, there are two emerges, all suffering, all sentient beings. And that verse is called, you know, the verse of dedication. So in that, it's got all these great wishes that Shanti Deva makes, is that may I be a road, may I be a bridge, maybe I'll be food and drink, may I be whatever it is that sentient beings need, may I be that. He says again and again and again. So all of that, that 10th chapter, that's summed up there in the last verse. But for the first line, may the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. So this is for those people who have not yet generated a mind of enlightenment. So Shanti Deva is wishing, for all you people who have no idea about a mind of enlightenment, or even if you have and you have not yet generated it, may it arise, may it be generated by you, and may it grow. So this verse talks about the first three verses in the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. The excellence of bodhicitta, I think, is the first chapter. Then you confess all the negativities. And then there's a chapter on how to actually generate bodhicitta. So that line, may the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. That's the first three chapters. Then the next one is, may that born have no decline. So this can tell you bodhicitta can decline. You can create it, but then you can lose it. And these two chapters talk about, so this is chapters 4 and 5, may that born have no decline. And then there the major focus is upon carefulness and vigilance, meaning mindfulness and vigilance, how to create, like how to hold it tight and then make sure you don't lose it. So whereabouts in terms of the path can you lose the mind of enlightenment? Any idea? So when you first have it, if you generate this mind as an uncontrived mind, so when you contrive it, meaning when you rely upon the practice of the six causes and one effect, that's how you develop the mind of enlightenment. You go through 7 steps. If you are using those 7 steps, it's a contrived mind of enlightenment. Another way you can develop the mind of enlightenment is through the equalized exchange of self for others meditation. So if you're going through that step by step, it's contrived. So if you put them together, so now you've got 11 points, and you go through each one of them, and you're going through it like that, then develop it, it's contrived. Now this is very much like when you first hop into a car, and you haven't been driving very long, and you know, but they tell you what to do, isn't it?
That's right.
You have to speak to yourself, eh? That now I'm doing this, now I'm doing that.
Every 30 seconds, look at the mirror.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is right, right? This is what you do, right? But when you become a good driver, you don't really do that anymore, do you? You don't need to talk to yourself. You just do it. You hop in, you look in the mirror. You do everything, but without speaking to yourself. So that's uncontrived. You can drive a car, you don't need the instructions. Same with mind of enlightenment. Uncontrived means you're not using the instructions, you have it. you know how to drive. That's the difference. Uncontrived means you're relying upon the sort of thing and you really got to think it through and you create it. Uncontrived, no. You're a racing car driver. You know what to do. You hop in, you go. So once you have that mind, Now you enter the Mahayana path. If you have that mind, you're a bodhisattva, you have bodhicitta, and you are have entered the Mahayana path of accumulation. So there's a stage. It's just like sort of, you know, like, I guess in a way, when you first start driving, like for me, I might give it up because I don't like driving. I'm pretty paranoid about it. I've had a couple of accidents and I don't like even sitting in the cars, the passenger, seeing cars come on the, you know, Gold Coast Highway. It freaks me out. So I'm not going to drive. But this was going to happen in the mind of the moment. You can generate it. You enter the path. But after a while, he goes, I can't do this. It's impossible. It's too hard. In fact, there's great stories of this happening, where great meditators have actually entered the path, and then it's often so they get tricked by a demon of some sort, you know. So I think this is the way of saying, yeah, you got overcome by an affliction, and you have to give it up. You couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah. When you go past that, is that what they call irreversible?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, you won't irreversible. Yeah, you won't lose it.
At what stage does it become irreversible? You said the first part.
Yeah, I think there's some. I know, but I've just forgotten.
Uh-huh.
No, I don't want to say this one is quite wrong,
yeah.
Stefan.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's different stages you go through in these paths. And sometimes you can lose what you've understood. Its strength decreases, or like you say, in terms of you losing the mind of enlightenment. Right? So one of the stories goes, this meditator, he's developed the mind of enlightenment, and then he meets what they call a demon, which just basically means a troublemaker, some sort of troublemaker. And oftentimes they seem to be external, but they might also be internal. Because, yeah, these are just stories, right, to help us understand. And so the demon says to him, if you really had bodhicitta, you'd give me one of your eyes. Yeah. Yeah. So the fellow goes, well, I have bodhicitta. Yeah. So he reaches up and plucks it out with his hand, and gives the eye. And then this person says, you gave me your eye with the hand that you wiped your bottom. You know, because you've got right hand and left hand. And so whatever the wrong hand was, I went, oh, that's the hand for doing that. Well, what a disgusting thing to do. And this guy goes, Jesus, you can't please anybody, can you? You give them your eyes, and they complain about the hand that gives you the eye. So he sort of went, that's it, sentient beings. I've had enough of them. He gave it up. You know? So this is just a story to illustrate how this can take place. Yeah, so you know, we know that sentient beings are difficult.
We've got a saying as well, you know, you give them an inch, they want a foot.
Yeah. Take a mile.
Yeah.
Give an inch, take a mile.
Oh, I've heard this one.
But I'll get your one too, yeah. You want this, but actually give them this and then they want something else.
They want something more.
That's right. Yeah, and then so then, but increase forevermore, and that takes the last four verses, 6, 7, 8, 9, and this last verse is the 10th verse. So the whole text is in this little verse here. And then there is also this dedication. So just as Manjushri knew how, just as Samantra Bhadra also knew, I dedicate this verse that I may learn to follow all their ways. I dedicate all my root virtues in whatever way. All Tathagatas of all three times praised as best. I dedicate them toward these noble deeds. Now, what this is sort of saying is these two bodhisattvas, Manjushri, who represents wisdom, and Samantabhadra for generosity, I'm going to follow the way that they dedicate it. So, of course, so in here we're trying to get this idea of empty appearance. So the merit or whatever's offered, whatever's dedicated, Sumantra was a bodhisattva who made immense offerings, but also immense dedications, huge dedications. And what we should, as it says here, just as Manjushri knew how. So this is being saying Manjushri, remember, the merits of dedicating is empty of any intrinsic nature. Sumantra Bhadra dedicates huge merit, like all the merit of his own and anyone else and everything, right, towards this goal of enlightenment. So you say, like, dedicate it all. Like, big dedications, but remember, they're all empty of any intrinsic nature. Don't cling to them as being something special or real or belonging to you. That's what he's sort of getting at. So these two high-level bodhisattvas, that's what they're renowned for. And then he goes, I dedicate all my root virtues in whatever way, all the Tathagatas of all three times praised as best. So whatever the Buddhas have said, this is the best way you can dedicate your merit. He says, I'll do it your way. I'll do it the way you say. So, you know, so again, this fellow I told you about who came and said, I've just come here to make friends. This is his main way of dedicating. So every time he dedicates now, I dedicate all my root virtues in whatever way, all the Tathagatas of all three times praise his best. That's the one he mainly uses. For some of you, like, you know, when you look, you might find a dedication that you really like, you know. So, and then so that when you come to the pujas and things at the end, you know, we often say we dedicate. So if you've memorized one that really makes good sense to you, you can just off it goes. You know, it can just come up. Because I've noticed that what people do is oftentimes we have these large gatherings here. We all practice together and we're making all these offerings. At the end comes dedication time. And nearly everybody, for quite some time, not so much now, but you listen to their dedications. They're all about this life. None of them are about enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings. Hardly anyone says, may I become enlightened for the benefit of all. May this merit we've created bring everybody to enlightenment. They're talking about their mothers in the hospital or sicknesses and lots of things about this life. May it bring this, may it bring that. They're going, man, what a pity. You know, why not add that little bit more? Why not add, may my mum become enlightened? That'd be terrific if she were. What's wrong with that? Hey. Yeah. You see, just recover from hospital. Mm. Yeah, we always end up back there, though. So, yeah, why not make it bigger? Anyway, it has changed a bit, hasn't it, Ian? We've noticed as people, you know, I sort of complained. So I've noticed, you know, we're not dedicating the best way. I want the best outcomes for everyone here. So use the mind of enlightenment. Same thing, dedicate with it and motivate with it. So, finally, anything interesting to you? Just we've got one more meditation, and that'll be the end of our show tonight. Yeah, and these are things we can all do well. Right? The meditations, I tell you, they're not easy. But this business is simple, isn't it? You just start something off with just you thinking and saying and going, yeah, that makes good sense to me. That's what I want. And at the end, saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. And in the middle, you can be all over the place. No matter how good or bad it's done, it's why it's done. Okay, last meditation then. So again, just get comfortable. Let your body settle with each exhalation. And then create an altruistic intention to make every positive effort that you make in your life a cause for the greatest possible good. In your own time, just think it through now. Create a motivation. Okay, now I think that we have done work here. We've been thinking, talking, we're talking about a good topic. So they want to dedicate this. The dedication consciously steers the positive energy from our actions towards this infinite goal. Sentient beings are infinite. The qualities of Buddhahood are infinite. We don't want our merit to be lost, so please dedicate it towards the greatest good you can think of. Now recollect emptiness in whatever way you can. Come at it through dependent arising. It's easier. And because I exist dependently, I'm empty of any intrinsic nature. Because the effort I've just extended trying to understand the mind of enlightenment is also dependent. It also has no intrinsic nature. Buddhahood, does it objectively exist or is it a dependent arising? So Buddhahood depends upon effort. I think this is akin to none of it. None of it is me, none of it is mine. Breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale. It's funny, I was just saying, I was thinking, wow, all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, all those beings have dedicated it the right way, and ours has joined them. It's not ours. Okay, so our takeaway today is it's best make it, aim high. Just try to understand what this thing is. Dedicate it that way. And then, of course, at the end, dedicate it again. Make sure, this is why I've been sitting here talking. This is my purpose in life. I'd like to achieve that. And remember, even if you don't achieve it this life, you'll have another life. And then another. So it's not going to waste. like you want to have access to this. Okay, so there is some material up online. So we have LTC class notes. So you have a look at number 4 on pages 29 to 32. And it's meditations on pages 3 and 4. So next week, we're looking at some of the common mental obstacles that we face when we meditate and then what their antidotes are. So let's dedicate. So this is a real common one, isn't it? So here, remember, so the merit has no true existence, existing in mere name. I, who's dedicating, have no true existence, but do exist in name. And so do all beings. And so does the enlightenment state. It exists in mere name, meaning unfindable when searched for, having no objective existence. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme dual bodhicitta not yet born rise in them. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as the space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The long life and prayer for His Holiness. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. In holding and spreading the moon's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged, incomparable benefit to you and make this request.